I'm Andrew Pariser. I work at Blue State Digital, and thank you everyone for coming out today. What I'm going to talk about is the 2010 Brazilian presidential campaign. Of course, the story of this starts for me at least in 2009 when I went down to Brazil to meet with the campaign manager and some of the campaign team and talk about the potential of digital in the campaign. We went down, we interviewed the campaign, did a bunch of research, then went back down and presented to Dilma on a strategy, and then over the course of the next year helped build a couple websites, launch a social media program, email communications, et cetera, et cetera. But before I get into any of that stuff, I actually just want to pull back. Over the next hour, I want to just talk through a little bit about our assessment of Brazilian politics in 2010 and what that would mean when it came to activating voters, because the whole goal of the digital program was going to be to get voters excited and involved. And then our assessment of the digital realm in Brazil in 2010, and then walk through the plan, and eventually at the end I'll fast forward to 2012 and talk about what the future looks like for both the Brazilian election in 2014, but also the latest and greatest when it comes to digital campaigning and some of the stuff going on in the Obama campaign. So to start, before I go into any of that, I thought I should tell a little bit about why I and Blue State was involved. For those that don't know, my firm, Blue State Digital, we're a little bit of a hybrid. We're an agency that runs sort of strategic digital engagements and does works with organizations on relationship marketing. We also have a technology, a tool set that powers campaigns that includes a CRM, mass mailer, donation processing, etc. We were founded in 2004 coming out of the Howard Dean campaign. The founders worked on that campaign, and while it went down, the campaign itself kind of went down in flames, it was the first campaign that really leveraged the internet to mobilize voters by tens and hundreds of thousands and bring in millions and millions of dollars. And they took the best practices they had learned from that, the strategies, the creative, and went out and started building a tool set that didn't really exist that would be tailored towards future political campaigns, and also built up an agency to help organizations run and do this electoral work. In 2007, we partnered with the Obama campaign. One of the founders of the firm went to head up the digital team in Chicago that would grow into about 100 people. Our tools were used by the campaign, and this sort of powered this work powered the $500 million that Obama raised via email and the social networking and activism that was seen there. So that's our background and why, come 2009, the PT, the party in Brazil, and Dilma was interested in us coming down and talking about what we had learned from the Obama campaign and how applicable that was in Brazil. So before answering that question of how applicable it was, I want to step back and talk about the state of democracy in Brazil at the time. So when we looked at it, the first thing we realized is that voters in Brazil were not particularly active when compared to the U.S. From 64 to 85, the military ran the country without elections, and when the presidency was restored, it wasn't a coup, it wasn't a people rising up, it was peacefully handed back from the military. And I think that's a very important thing, is that there wasn't a lesson from this moment of time about the power of people or of civic unrest. There wasn't a moment where the whole country came together. And then as elections started, people didn't really see the need to get so involved. And the level of volunteering and sort of activism in elections is much lower than what we see here. So our conversation with the campaign immediately focused around, can we get people involved? Can we get people engaged? This was going to be the sort of key question. And the graphic I have up here is a corruption index, which shows that, Brazil's sort of in the middle of the pack here, and that there's a very healthy level of skepticism amongst voters about the government. During the Lula's administration from 2002 to 2010, the previous president, there were a lot of scandals. There were a lot of his cabinet members had to resign. Dilma actually became the chosen successor because others who seemed to be the chosen successors were involved in scandals and had to resign and couldn't end up running. So, the takeaway here, of course, is that it was going to be a challenge to get people to really mobilize and care. So, quick just nuts and bolts here. Elections are mandatory, so there's it's not like in the U.S. where there's a lot of effort around getting out the vote and convincing people to go to the polls. Everyone has to vote. TV ads are given by this, are funded by the state. Essentially, they're 10-minute, they're almost like mini TV shows. And fundraising is not a major concern of the parties. This is just something that they're not worried about. For the campaign itself, they have an unusual, at least by the U.S. standards, the campaign's only 3 months, which right now in the U.S. would sound kind of great. It's a very short amount of time for politicians to introduce themselves, get their message out, and let voters know them. What ends up happening is there's a pre-campaign where for about 3 months before the official campaign, the candidates do start going around the country and are... there's no real word to describe it because they are essentially campaigning, but they can't do any of the official things. They can't talk about voting for them. They can't run TV ads. They're very hamstrung by the law. But ultimately, there's 3 months of an official campaign and a three-month campaign before that. There are no primaries. The candidates from each party are basically selected by the party leaders and are run there. So, there's no... Once they're off at that six-month marker, you already have your candidates for each party, and there's none of what we see here in the U.S. today. So, digital in Brazil. Now, all of what I'm about to talk to you is digital in Brazil as of 2010. It's changed quite a bit since then, and I'll get to that also. In 2010, there was 194 million Brazilians with just under 80 million internet users. There was also, you can see, the mobile phone penetration is remarkable with more mobile phones than there are people. But at the time, there were only 19 million smartphones. So that means that really only 10% of the population was accessing the internet through mobile. To break this down further, of the 80 million internet users, we see that one-third of them are primarily accessing the internet through cafes. We also see about only one quarter are using the internet at home. So of the users, there's a lot of people using it from work, from cafes, home. This is sort of equal distribution across those three areas. It was just something for us to keep in mind in terms of how much time people would have and the environment they're in when they're actually going and interacting with the election. The other key point here to jump on is that at the time, Facebook and Twitter had not surpassed 10 million users in Brazil yet. Orkut was at about 36 million. Since 2010, Facebook has actually passed Orkut, and Twitter, I believe, is growing at, it's the second or third fastest pace in the world of any country in Brazil. So these numbers have shot up. But at the time, we're looking at just under 10 million people for these platforms. So when you think of a country with 190 million people where there are going to be 130 million votes cast, what can Facebook and Twitter realistically do for you? Well, there's a limit to how many people you're going to reach from them. There's a limit to what kind of a community you're going to build. But what we realized is that the candidate... was going to need to be a different kind of candidate, and that the medium of these could become part of a message. So more on that in a little bit. Sorry. Is that better? All right. So the campaign. So we have here Dilma versus Jose Serra. And who is Dilma? Dilma was a first-time candidate in 2010 for president, which is pretty unusual. She's someone who in the 1970s had been something of a radical. She was in prison for 3 years for military activism. She then had gone back and become an economist and joined Lula's administration in 2002 and sort of was known as no nonsense. She was called the Iron Lady by many. She started off as his energy secretary and became his chief of staff and was ultimately in the second semester credited with sort of running the operation. Her number one advantage was Lula. Lula's popularity in 2010 was in the 70, you know, he had favorability in the 70% range. He had a very emotional connection with the voters. There was an incredible amount of love for him. If he could have run again for office, he was term limited, but if he could have run again, he would have won in a landslide. So, you know, his selecting her was really the most important part of her campaign was that relationship. Her challenges in this campaign, I've listed some of the same things that were assets were also challenges. So the fact that she's a first-time candidate is something where people didn't know her that well. She wasn't that well-known when she was selected. So getting them to familiar with her, getting people comfortable to actually vote for a president where they don't know her that well, that would be really, really important. The lack of a primary is both an asset and a challenge. It helps that the party is unified. It helps that there's a very strong coalition around her. But at the same time, no primary means, again, it's a shortened window for people to get to know a first-time candidate. So it's both a blessing and a curse. And then the fact that she was a political activist is something that, you know, some people loved and some people hated. And I have some photos here from when she was sent to jail originally, and it was something where there were those that were trying to brand her as something of a terrorist in the 70s and not a political activist, but a loose cannon, someone who couldn't be trusted, someone who wasn't a patriot. And the, you know, the story of her life was something that some people loved and some people didn't. So it was something that we were going to have to get out in front. The last bullet point here on her, though, also is that as a first-time candidate and someone who was known as sort of running the operation, someone who was very good at the infrastructure, she wasn't seen as telegenic or charismatic. I personally, when I met her, I thought she was incredibly charismatic and charming and really incredibly in control of a room. I guess it's just something that wasn't projecting on through television. Okay, so her opponent, Jose Serra, there was something about him that reminded us a little of John McCain in 2008. He had, like McCain, he had run 8 years before and lost. He had lost to Lula in 2002. He was coming across very much as, you know, he was on the conservative ticket, and that party was seen as a little bit of out of touch. He also, the contrast between him and Dilma was very interesting. He, in the 1970s, when she was protesting for democracy and thrown in jail, he was in Europe studying and, you know, could definitely get branded as a cultural elite. So, and he also wasn't seen as telegenic or charismatic. So it was something where they were sort of awash when it came to the personality, and the obvious contrast to them were something we could take advantage of. So now that we've sort of set the stage about, you know, the challenges with the democracy in Brazil and the candidate, here's what we did. We started here. We started with Dilma being nominated. It reminds me of, 100 years ago in the U.S. when, you know, there's this idea that there were party leaders and party elders who were in a smoke-filled back room and just handpick someone to run for the party. That's really where we started. And we also started with, you know, the fact that she's a woman and that she's going to run is really a remarkable thing. You can look at this picture of Lula and cabinet members, and she really does stand out. And it's something where people don't know her. So we're standing with her very far apart. She's been selected to run. She's not really known. And, you know, this is going to be tough to get people to warm to her. So what we then did is we used this relationship, her and Lula, the fact that she was his right hand, that she was effectively in many ways running the government that people love, the fact that he was beloved and that she was a part of that. We used this relationship to communicate this, to sort of introduce her in this manner. And the goal was to get to here, where she was with the people, where she was personable, where she was reachable, where she was someone who wasn't, as opposed to Jose Serra, she was a member of the cultural elite, but someone who was going to fight for everyone. And that was really going to be the goal. So how would digital do that? Or how would digital be one of the key parts of that? So the first thing, Twitter. In 2010, on the day she launched her campaign, she also launched a Twitter handle, and she was the one actually tweeting behind it. And the point was, it's a small thing. As I said, there are less than 10 million people, Brazilians, on Twitter at the time, and it wasn't going to be about reaching all of those people and mobilizing them. It was going to be that the medium was the message. So what that meant was the act of her opening up a Twitter handle, as she declares, was pitched to the press as she's going to make herself available in a way that past candidates haven't. She's going to use this new technology that really hasn't been used so much in past campaigns to create a two-way dialogue with the voters. She's going to do it, and she's not just going to be sending campaign staff in at it. She's going to be personally involved with it. So the medium becomes the message, and the press ate it up. The press spent a lot of time not just writing about the campaign, but a disproportionate time writing about certain mechanics behind it, including the digital program. So by just, in one sense, representing the digital program in this way, we've started the rebranding of Dilma, we've started by introducing her in a unique way where she's there to have this two-way conversation. Over the course of the campaign, she went from 0 to 350,000 followers. It's not a massive amount, but again, at a point where there were, I think, 8.6 million Twitter users in total, it was a decent percentage. The next thing we did... I think that you have to start with the demographic of users of Brazil. So I don't have data on that exactly from 2010, but what we had that, you know, you have to start with, there's 80 million internet users of a population of 195 million, and on average, that's a more affluent audience, that 80 million users. So the people on Twitter, you know, it was a bit more educated, a bit more urban, a bit more, a bit more of the professional class, I would say. I think it was 8. No? Okay. Interesting. I have to check my research. So the next thing we did was the party launched a mobilization site. This was separate from Dilma, but what this was about getting people involved. And there's a couple little things in here. One is, you know, you see here you have the button downloads. Because a third of the users were at internet cafes, and because only a third of the population had access to the internet, one of the questions that we wanted to address is how do we get people to marry the online and the offline here? In other words, can we enable the activists, the people who really care, to do something that's going to reach the people who aren't online? So it's a small thing, but one of the things we pushed was that people could go, and there was all these, we had designed all these different sort of assets, and they could print them out and take them around. And we emailed, you know, volunteers and pushed them to take these actions, and we actually got tens of thousands of people to download stuff. And we can't, there are no analytics to track how they were passed around and stuff, but just the fact that we're getting people to download stuff and print it out was one of the things of just starting to turn her supporters into evangelists. Other things here simply is, we just made it very action-oriented. It's a standard thing in U.S. politics, but when I show you Jose Serra's site, you'll see that there was no engagement opportunities. So everything here above the fold, people can sign up, they can get involved, they can volunteer, they can spread the word. All this stuff we were pushing right away, and that was actually the first time that a website for Brazilian politics was emphasizing the action so much and not about just content consumption. The next website we had was Bio on Dilma. This was launched during the pre-campaign before it could be about voting. You see right away we have a welcome message from her. A lot of the content focused on this relationship between her and Lula. Again, very action-oriented website so that people could get involved. And what we did in the sort of pre-campaign before it could be about voting, before it could be about the election really, was we made it, why do people care? We asked people, why do you care about this candidate? Why are you involved? Share your story. And what we found is that people participated. And that getting, sending to, tens of thousands of people an email asking them, why do you care? You can't respond to all of those people at once. But what you can do is you can take a couple of the stories you get in and in the next email follow up and say, hey, here's what we got. Here's what we heard. And you start showing the other people in the community that that people are participating, that this is a campaign unlike past campaigns where people are going to get more involved, where people are going to be spreading the word. And we started building this over time, and we found that the amount of return users we're getting to the website started to increase right away and things like that. So, but again, the goal of this initial site was to simply introduce her to the public and get her to be known. After 3 months of that, we were then able to launch with the campaign website. And again, I think that what marked this off is that it was actually a very clean website. It's not overly busy. It's very the information was presented in a systematic way. We were emphasizing what people could do with the campaign just as much as we were emphasizing her issues and information about her. And that was, again, a departure from how this had been done before. Other things that we did, we had to build out a ton of, you have to present the candidate. You have to build out a ton of content on who the candidate is. And in this case, you have to be careful about the content that's out online. So in 2008, every piece of misinformation in the world or accusation was lobbied at Obama in the U.S. about where was he born, what religion is he a socialist, all this stuff. And the campaign didn't want to respond to each of these attacks in Obama's voice. What happens when the campaign responds in the candidate's voice is you elevate the issue. You make it more important. You make more people pay attention to it. It's why it was a couple years before he finally released his long-form birth certificate. But at the same time, you don't want to ignore what's going on out there, especially in the online community when people are Googling this stuff. If the results that are being returned are negative or misinformation, it's a real, real problem. So for the Obama campaign in 2008, separate from the campaign, a website called Truth Fights Back was launched with a bit of online advertising and a lot of search engine optimization behind it. And what it was a place where all the information and all the attacks were corrected. And the actual correct record on Obama was presented there. And it was run by community members. So in having regular voters put the content together, they're able to correct the information, correct the record, without it being elevated in the voice of Obama. And the point was is that, you know, this is just one of the many things you have to do in the face of this stuff. So with Dilma, someone who has been accused of being a terrorist, someone who is a recent cancer survivor, and people were concerned, is she really healthy? You know, someone who's a first-time candidate, someone who's a woman running for president when that, you know, when the country hasn't had a female president before, someone who just had a ton of attacks on her, it was very important that there was a place where the information could be, you know, where the correct information could be found, and that when people Googled for her, just like in the Obama campaign in 08, they would actually find the correct history of her time in jail. They would find the correct story of her medical health at that point, and that this is what was returned right away. Other things here. Community participation. I've gone back and forth in mentioning this a few times, but the most important thing to us, I think, was, again, presenting her, who she was, correcting the record, but also getting people involved. So when we launched, before you even got to the homepage, there was always a splash page on the site, something we changed, you know, on a regular basis, but there was always a splash page asking people to get involved, asking people to take part, letting them know that they were a part of this campaign, sharing the ownership of it. And that was, again, something that we didn't see across any other of the candidates that were out there. This is Jose Serra's site. I think that, again, as I've said throughout, what you see here is, regardless of if you liked it, love the design, hate the design, when you're above the fold, there's really not that much you can do. There's not a place to sign up. There isn't a list of actions for you to take right away in the same way. There were actions on his site. It's not that he wasn't asking people to get involved. It was just a completely different priority. It was a completely different message he was pushing. And, you know, it has had a very different tone, message, and approach. So what happened? Well, the first thing that happened, of course, and the most important thing that happened, is she won. She didn't win in the first ballot. She got 46.9% of the vote. Brazil requires a plurality, so 50% plus one. So there was a runoff between her and Jose Serra, where she ultimately won by 12 million votes at the end of October in 2010. The next thing here is how many people went and looked at her site. So we have 4.6 million people visited her site over a little over a 6 month period. But what's really the real lesson in here is you see this number spike in the end. And it's not surprising that the consumption would go up before the final election. But what's really interesting is that it didn't go up before that much before the first election. And what this is a lesson about how ingrained digital is within a campaign team. So from day one, when we were working with the campaign, we were asking for integration between online and offline. So on our end, we used the list of supporters she built up to push events, to push people to go and see her where she was going, to push people to come together. And what we hope, you know, what we were talking to the campaign team about was that TV commercials needed to send people to her site. It needed to list the URL. It needed to have a strong action. But the reality of that campaign was that the digital team didn't quite have a seat at the leadership table the way, say, the digital team for the Obama campaign did in 08. So the result was the TV commercials were not pushing people to the website that much in right before the first election. But after October 3rd, when she ran and didn't get the 50% plus one, the campaign got very scared. And immediately thereafter, all commercials pushed people to her website, included the URL, included a call to action, and we see this huge spike. And it's the simplest thing, it's the easiest thing, and I just think it's a lesson where it's not even, there's, you know, I think it's a lesson about for all campaigns and making sure that across all the different channels that you're communicating, having them be integrated reinforces them. You know, we see on the next slide here, you see a spike in email addresses. You know, and this is something where, you know, if there was a spike in email addresses earlier, you know, what would that have done for the campaign? How much of a difference would that have meant if we had that earlier, in terms of other stuff we could drive? So again, I think it's something where, you know, this was the first, this isn't even to cast any aspersions. This is something where there's a great lesson here about the importance of linking all the channels. So some conclusions about what we saw in the data in between the Facebook, Orkut, Twitter profiles we created and what we did with email. Going to the campaign, the Brazilian press wrote a couple articles about how social media, you know, is growing exponentially in Brazil. And, you know, there was a lot of internal discussions where the campaign didn't think email would be particularly would be a particularly valuable tool. They thought that it was going to be about social networking and not about emails. But that's not the story the data told. If you add up the amount of website visits that Twitter, Orkut, and Facebook generated across this campaign, it doesn't even... all of them together are still less than email. Email was still the primary channel to drive action, whether it was sending people to events or getting them to share stories or tell their friends. In the U.S., email, of course, fundraising is, you know, email is primarily used for fundraising, and not primarily used for fundraising, but is the best tool for driving donations. In Brazil, of course, there wasn't, you know, driving donations wasn't a part of the campaign. But what we still found is that, you know, when we looked through everything we did, daily posts on Facebook, you know, regular tweeting by the candidate herself, email still drove more people's attention than any of the other stuff. Yeah, so I think that there, we didn't do for this campaign analysis of how many people who were Facebook fans were also on email and that kind of stuff. I think that there's always some overlap here. But this wasn't about, like, I think the lesson here isn't so much about individually who these people are, but about how these channels are at driving action. And that email still was a more effective channel at driving action.
Did you get any sense as to if there were operational or functional or experiential elements about the Facebook Orkut interactions that may have been a sort of an inhibitor of engagement there, or do you really, or do you have a sense that that might be more a part of just digital divide, internet cafe access, and email engagement just in general is something people are more comfortable with?
It's a really good question, and I unfortunately don't have. We didn't have the analytic tools to answer that. I think we would now, but we didn't then. I think, you know, underlying why this is so important is at the end of the campaign, we looked back and we saw that 27,000 people had used our tool on the website to email a friend about Dilma, and that altogether it was about 440,000 emails that they had sent to friends. And, a standard... you know, 101 lesson in marketing is that word of mouth marketing, being told about something from a friend, is far more valuable than seeing a TV commercial for it. And, you know, again, the point here is that 27,000 people isn't the biggest number in this country, but that nearly 500,000 people were hearing about Dilma from friends online is actually kind of an impressive sign that if we give her supporters the tools to talk about her, they would. And that if we engage them and ask them to be participants in the campaign, what we're going to see like this word of mouth buzz. And this is just online. You know, there was no way to measure how many more conversations this pushed between people. But I think just from everyone's experience in following, you know, campaigns here in the U.S. and the Obama campaign in 08, where people are talking about it far, you know, and the stuff that's going on online is generating that enthusiasm. That's what we're getting at here. This is sort of the evidence that by engaging in a different way, you know, people started to talk about the campaign. So, I'm going to skip ahead to lessons learned from this campaign. Let me just check for time. So I think that the first thing is that 6 months, you know, a 3 month campaign, a 3 month free campaign is a short amount of time. And that you saw the email list spiking at the end, you saw the website visits spiking at the end, but all that infrastructure, all that stuff that we had, would have been really great to have had that earlier in the campaign and had, you know, more time to build the community. The first lesson, of course, is that people, you know, politicians need to have sort of a year-round presence to be building this infrastructure so that when campaign time comes, there's something to leverage. I think the next lesson here was there is a thirst for personal connections. And what we see in the stories that were shared and what we see in asking people to interact and what we see in what content was viewed in terms of the sheer amount of photos and videos that were viewed, which were tremendous, you know, millions of pages of photos and videos viewed on her websites. We see that people really do want to connect. We also see that the online can drive the offline. I think one of the more successful parts of this campaign was that the email list was generating a lot of event attendance for her. She went around and a lot of awareness of where she was. I think another thing we saw was that it was more the message, the content we pushed forth was more important than fancy technology. Her opponent's campaign had a lot of widgets and sort of the latest and greatest gadgets on the website, but wasn't asking people to participate. So it might have been cool, but they weren't driving that conversation. They weren't driving actions that lead to votes, which is really what this is all about. And I think that's a major lesson here. And then the final thing, something I touched upon earlier with the medium being the message, is that if Dilma was going to be presented, you know, if we were going to have to soften her, if we were going to have to make her more personal, if we were going to have to make people not see her as the Iron Lady, but see her as someone that they could have an emotional connection with and trust to become president, we were going to have to engage people and get them involved. And we were also going to have the press carry forth a message that this was happening. Because it wasn't just going to be about reaching the few million people who are on Twitter and Facebook and talking to them. It was going to be about having buzz go beyond it. So the simple act of doing this and talking about it was something that we were trying to get a sort of a long tail of awareness that this was a candidate that wasn't the Iron Lady, but someone who wanted to connect with the people. So looking ahead, because this camp, you know, it's 2012. She's been in office for about 15 months already. How's she doing? So, first of all, she's looking very strong right now. Her favorability has climbed up to close to sort of what Lula's was. I don't think anyone thinks, despite that number being so high, that she has the popularity, the sort of the depth of popularity that he has. He carried that for years and years and is still very, very, very much loved. He can run again in 2014. The Constitution there limits you to 2 consecutive terms, but not 2 terms over your lifetime. And his shadow persists, and there's certainly quite a few stories about it. Having said that, his health, he's recently undergone treatment for cancer. His health is very much in question. I don't think there are that many people who really know the dynamic of the relationship between Lula and Dilma that well to be able to predict what will happen. The fact that Brazil has really, over the last few years, avoided the worst parts of the recession has been key. And, you know, economic growth has gone a bit up and down, but they have comparatively done much better than other countries. It just really does leave Dilma in a very strong place. She's also seen as a very strong leader. Quite a few of... She's run through quite a few cabinet secretaries already, and been seen as someone who's demanding and running sort of a tighter ship than has been run before. The last point I wanted to make, though, as we look ahead, that I think is particularly interesting, is when I Googled Brazilian democracy, the second result that came up is an article in the Daily Beast, a little bit of a snarky article, titled "Brazil's One-Party Democracy," and it wonders aloud if Brazil is at a point where the PT is going to be in power for the foreseeable future if the PT has a stranglehold and no one can usurp them. And this is really, really remarkable when you consider that the PT had never won the presidency until 2002 and is a party that really has only been around for a couple decades. Personally, I very much, think that this is a bit overdone, this one-party democracy thing, and, you know, there's going to be a lot of back and forth in the ensuing years, but it's a remarkable sign of how strong her presidency, how successful Lula's presidency was, and how strong hers has started. So I wanted to stop here because, again, this is a campaign from 2 years ago, and a lot of what we talked through was really about what we would say is in some ways basics when it comes to digital campaigning. It was the first time on a national level a lot of those tools were rolled out and used consistently. And I think it's just interesting to look at when we think of what's going to happen next in Brazil in 2014. I think it's interesting to look at what's happening in the Obama campaign now in 2012 to tell us about some of the trends and what's going to be really important when it comes to digital in the future. So I think the first thing is that mobile has exploded. In 2010, the first iPads were coming out, and the mobile penetration at the time of smartphones in Brazil was 19 million, and since then it's really gone exponentially up. So what we're seeing is across U.S., Brazil, everywhere, the consumption of mobile. Of consumption of websites on mobile is increasing every year. It really means that people have to have an incredibly strong presence on mobile. So that means that everything that's done has to be optimized. It takes a lot of resources to do this. It's a considerable investment. But as we see that more people in the U.S. donate over their phone, as we see, we'll see more people in Brazil sign up or participate or learn about the event from their mobile phone. And it just means that we're going to, it's just incredibly important to make sure that when people get to the landing page, it's not just about the homepage, but wherever they enter the site, they're having an experience where they can interact and take part. The other thing we're seeing, again, email is still the best channel when it comes to driving action. Email is still the most effective tool for driving donations. It's still the most effective tool for driving volunteerism. And, despite the proliferation of social networks and, Facebook's march towards a billion members, when it comes to a campaign leveraging the internet to get people to take action, email is the winner. Other thing we're seeing, there's an increasing amount of online tools for micro-targeting, for learning about your audience, for being able to deliver highly targeted messages to your audience. I think we've seen in the last few years the explosion of advertising on Facebook and, their ability to let you target, by someone's, combine someone's age and where they live and what their interests are and create a profile of them. This is something that campaigns are investing in are investing in tools to gather this data across the entire online spectrum so that it's not just about using a tool like Facebook, but it's gathering profiles and having an understanding of where their audiences are and learning about them. There's still dangers. People still aren't realizing that everybody's watching all the time and they have to be smart. A couple things that I think are unbelievable. We grabbed some Twitter feeds from BP where at one point they wrote, "We've pledged $75 million towards the $40 billion cleanup." $75 million sounds like a lot until you read the words $40 billion. The one above is, "We've asked, we've got time to find volunteers to smile and drink Gulf water on camera. Please help. So they're tweeting out a message looking for volunteers for their PR. I mean, it's very tone deaf. It's very unaware of the audience. It's very unaware that you're not that tweeting at some people, they're going to be seen by everyone. I have a picture of Anthony Weiner here as another example, of course, just someone who forgot that, just completely, you know, well, he was an idiot. What can you say? He's a complete idiot. And I think that, you know, as we asked Dilma to tweet on the campaign, something she was really excited about first and then got a little tired of as time went on, you know, you just have to remember there are risks and that you can't undo what's said. At the same time, there's just no question that there's a tremendous amount of power from doing this stuff, from opening up and having two-way conversations. You know, what we've seen in the Middle East in the last year, it's just, you know, it's a tool that everyone can connect. And if people approach it transparently and authentically, the power is there. And I think that, you know, a final example here is that even as President Obama has still gone out of his way to sort of, you know, have chats with people via questions that come in with Twitter, to, you know, go up on YouTube, to use these tools to create virtual town halls. And again, when we go back to the message of the media, one of the realities is he's now the president of the United States. I mean, you know, that is a very different thing than when he was running in 2008. But he's still making the effort. He hasn't, just because he's become president, he hasn't changed his approach. He's still making the effort to connect with people via the online channel in different ways, and that's unique. So I think that's the end of this, and I'd love to take any questions anyone has for the next few minutes. Sorry, we have a...
You mentioned that you expect that mobile will become a significant component of political campaigning in Brazil over the next few cycles. The primary method that we know, I work for a wireless carrier. We have presence in Brazil. We know that the primary communication method for and engagement for most people is still messaging. And you showed that email is right up there. What things, if any, did you do from a text messaging campaign, text messaging engagement? Did you try any of it? How did you find working with local wireless operators? Or was that something you had resources to even talk about?
It was incredibly so the question is, what role did text messaging play in the campaign in 2010? And the answer is not nearly enough. There was a lot of infrastructure challenges to getting it up. It wasn't something that was within Blue State's sort of work order. The campaign was working with another partner on that stuff. And there was a plan to try and mobilize, and it never really, it took too long. They got to it too late. This is also another one of those challenges with a campaign that's 3 to 6 months. Messages were sent, but I don't think it played an effective role in the campaign. I know thereafter that once in government, I know the health ministry in Brazil is doing a lot of work to reach people via text message. You know, again, because the internet penetration is only so much in Brazil, but mobile penetration is fairly absolute. So text messaging out health alerts about diseases and stuff to remote regions has become a very important part of the health ministry's work there. And I think that, getting that set up and having that really rolling along now means that for the 2014 elections, you're going to see text messages play a much more prominent role. There's some back there.
Good morning. Apologies if this was covered before I walked in, which was 5 minutes ago, so apologies for that. Concerning the new outreach methods that you crafted for Dilma's election, being in Brazil at that time, there was a lot of conversations around Lula's influence on her messaging, her strategy, and her voice. So how were you able to use the tools that you created for her campaign to address the opinions that were given about Lula's proximity to her campaign?
Well, it's a mixed bag because I think that we definitely wanted that connection to be there. We definitely wanted we wanted Dilma to sort of have a little bit of the shine from Lula. We wanted to transfer that. So it wasn't about separating them. What it was more about was also pushing Dilma front and center so people got to know her and as a distinct person. So it was very much we wanted to marry their work together, but also introduce Dilma as a distinct personality, a distinct candidate for people to get to know. I think that was sort of the approach, which is you have to thread the needle a little with that. And I think that, Lula being an asset, though, is something where as you push out content, you didn't want to just ignore that, you didn't want to ignore that asset. So if you pushed out content, there was also quite a bit of content we pushed out that was Lula-focused, and it would be about driving people back to wanting to vote for Dilma, but, using the accomplishments of the past 8 years was the core part of the messaging. I think there's a mic coming. Right here.
You mentioned Obama's continued use of digital. Is Dilma also doing the same where she's continuing to do digital, or was this more of during the campaign?
No, I actually spoke at a Latin American political conference recently where, people were very there was a concern in the audience that, because she did tweet herself during the campaign and she stopped when she became president, that she only used it as a tool, that it was only used as a tool for campaigning, that she didn't actually believe in it. And I think the reality is that becoming president there's an increase in her responsibilities, and that, she hadn't tweeted before, and it's something where once she started tweeting, I think she found this just to be, she was trying to limit the amount of things she has to do, to be honest. So there's something, it hasn't been a big, I think the answer is it hasn't been a big priority there. I think that though she's only 15 months out of that election, and that there's still a long time before, there's still 2.5 years before her term's up, and we don't know where, I don't think we know yet how much she's going to go back towards this stuff, it hasn't been the same priority.
Thanks. Question about the youth vote and sort of the segmentation of the voters. As you were doing outreach, were you doing anything specific to get to certain groups?
Yeah, so a lot of our segmentation wasn't about, age. We didn't necessarily know, when we got email addresses and stuff, we didn't necessarily know age, but our segmentation was very much by where did this person come in and what actions have we seen taken. So if the people came in from the mobilization site for the party, that was treated more in terms of a youth group. It was treated more in terms of people who wanted to sort of spread the word and get involved. Also, segmentation was done by, are these people consistently opening emails? Have they taken an action? So segmentation was much more based around what they had done. We just didn't have that age demographic.
I'm sorry if this was covered earlier. This kind of extends off the last question, but as far as the demographics and the age demographics, where did you see the highest engagement kind of by platform? Was that one in one of the first slides? Probably. That's what I missed, so sorry.
So I'm bringing up... Sorry, give me 1 second. So as of this is all data as of 2010, but 63% of the online users were between 15 and 35. Anyone over 16 and over can vote in Brazil. So,
I'm sorry, but as far as like your conversion rates and who actually engaged.
I'm having trouble hearing you.
As far as your engagement rates, the engagement rates on your campaign, who actually converted, you know, as far as demographically, did some convert?
Yeah,
we
don't. Yeah, so we don't have that demographic data specifically. We just, you know, in the information we collected email and, you know, zip, well, equivalent of zip code there to, you know, so we knew where the people were, which meant we could target as she traveled around the country. We could send targeted message to people when she was in their state and things like that. But to make it as easy for people to participate as possible, when we get them in the door, we're not asking for much information. There's options for them to give a lot more once they've been gotten in the door, but the priority is to get them to participate. You can see here. I'll skip ahead. When we ask people to affiliate, you can see right here, you know, it says, you know, right here we just have an email address. On the other one, it was email plus name. We make it as simple as possible. You know, it's much more about just getting them in the door. So adding these splash pages increased, I think, the conversion rate, the amount of people came to the site and signed up. These splash pages increased it by 500%. They were redirected at times to places where we collected more information. They were redirected at times to places where we asked people to take additional actions, but we just didn't have the demographic data that you asked about. Right here.
It's a bit of a vague question. I'm wondering, in the work that you guys did, or any similar kind of works that you do, is it always based on just on the local Brazilian audience, so to speak, or is there any work you would do where you're trying to reach out to international influencers, anything like that? Because I feel like I was in Brazil at an early stage in the campaign where she was trying to establish herself a little bit with the international media, that she was really strong, and I was wondering if there's ever any work like that that happens.
Yeah. I mean, the focus is always just about, it's always a calculus of votes, votes, votes. It's always about what this action, putting forth this message, how is this going to lead to more votes? And as I was saying before about the demographic data, I mean, I think we captured people who, you know, we captured people who signed up. That didn't mean necessarily that, you know, that they weren't expatriates living abroad and other stuff. From a digital perspective, there wasn't a concerted effort towards that group. There may have been a little bit through other channels of the campaign, but it just wasn't a priority with digital.
Was there anything you thought that green lady did well? I forget her name, but she's,
Marta.
Yes.
Well, as a candidate, she was she has sort of a charisma and an energy that made her a very, very good candidate. From an online perspective, I thought that some of that translated in some of her messaging and content very well. I also think that at points they tried to do too many things. I think campaigns have to be careful to keep very focused on the core goal of getting people involved and pushing towards votes, and I think that there were times where we were looking at her message and her websites, and there was a little too much. You know, you could go in too many different directions, and it wasn't necessarily focusing people towards the core goals of getting votes. Anything else?
You hinted at it a little bit, but having gone through this experience, having seen what could be done in Brazil with just a little bit more early organization by a campaign, for example, or with a little bit more of an existing infrastructure, what would you see is, how do you see that that the political system in Brazil may or may not adopt digital as a mechanism for political engagement, and what do you see are the kinds of things that are really just very likely to happen within the next cycle, and things that they should be thinking about that might be different in Brazil than in other places?
I mean, I think Brazil is a maturing democracy. Again, as we said, you know, it's democracy, you know, democracy came back in 1985. That was the first presidential election in many years. And one thing you see in the United States is that there's a incredible class of political professionals built up around, you know, D.C. and in other areas. And the political consultants and lobbyists and on, I mean, there's just a huge amount of them. And this is going to grow in Brazil. You know, that sort of class and that sector is going to grow. And, you know, that's going to start to put its stamp on politics there. It's not that they don't already have some very, very, very talented people in politics. It's that it just hasn't, the infrastructure isn't quite look like it does in the United States. But it's going to move in that direction. And I think that's going to make a big difference. I think I'm seeing from here that we're at time. And thanks, everyone, for coming.